Welcome back to Dad's on the Air this Tuesday, 13 March 2012. And we've got a huge show today. We will be talking to Peter Fitzsimons, the well-known Sydney journalist who has a host of interests. And we'll be talking to him about, particularly about fatherhood, about his own relationship with his father and now that he's a father of three children himself, how he's passing on what he learned from his father. And that's in connection with his book, A Simpler Time. Later on, we'll be crossing up to Mullumbimby. That's about 15 minutes north of Byron Bay. And we'll be speaking to the one and only Neil Young. So we're all looking forward to that. So
not quite the one and only. There is another one.
We'll probably hear there are three. But anyway, three well-known ones. In any event, this is Bill Cable from Mediate Now. And in the studio today, we've got Ian Purdy from ianpurdy.com.
Yes, good morning, Bill, and good morning, listeners.
And so we've got a great show to get on with. We should just mention up front that don't forget our web address. It's www.dadsontheair.com.au, where you can find us on Facebook and join us on Twitter. So before we get on with our interviews, we might just look at a couple of items that have been appearing in the papers that have caught our eye. Particularly, I notice here an article from the Sydney Morning Herald. This was on last Saturday, and this was by Adele Horan. The heading is Fathers See Parenting Courses as Stuck in the 50s. And in the article, Adele Horan points out that fathers are averse to attending parenting education classes, and they do not seem to get the same benefits from them as mothers, in this, as shown by this new study. But, she points out, it is not the fault of fathers. It's as if parenting courses are stuck in the 1950s, where the gender division is accepted as natural and entrenched, said Richard Fletcher, head of the Fathers and Families Research Program at the University of Newcastle. Richard has been a guest on the program. He is probably Australia's leading researcher in this area. He says that it is absurd that a government-funded program should convey the message that mothers should take all the responsibility for child development, and it was the mother's behaviour that determined the child's success. His analysis, based on 28 published evaluations of the triple P groups, confirms father attendance rarely surpassed 20%. But he pointed out that from other research, we know fathers have an important role in managing their children and influencing their development. Dr. Fletcher is the author of The Dad Factor, and he said, if fathers are not involved, results will be worse for the children. So this is all very critical of the Triple P program. It's a favourite of the courts. But then the Triple P program was developed in Australia by the University of Queensland, and it was by Professor Matt Sanders and his team at the university. Of course, Professor Sanders defended the Triple P program, but I would have to say, having attended one of these, that I'm on the side of Richard Fletcher, and I don't think it has grappled with what's happened with fathers in the years since the 50s, and the more that fathers are much more important in the lives of their children, and they're much more involved. So this idea that is promoted in the Triple P is a dated and dangerous idea. Yes, well, now just moving on to another type of depression, but if you are a father and you've suffered from postnatal depression, or if you are the partner of a man that has experienced postnatal depression, there is a study being conducted by the Sociology and Anthropology Department of the University of New South Wales, and in particular by Rebecca Oxley. And Rebecca has written to us and said that she would welcome correspondence from those with a wide variety of ethnicities, cultures and family types. Sufferers may have been diagnosed by a medical professional or even self-diagnosed. Participants in this study must be 18 years or older and be happy to engage in a semi-structured interview of approximately 60 minutes duration. So if that describes you, if you would like to, or someone you know, if you would like to participate or request some further information, please contact Rebecca Oxley, O-X-L-E-Y, at the Sociology and Anthropology Department of the University of New South Wales. You can send her an email to r.oxley Oxley at student.unsw.edu.au. That's r.oxley at student.unsw.edu.au. Or you can phone her, and her phone number is 0449 696 189, 0449 696 189. So that's Rebecca Oxley. Now we go overseas for an article that appeared in the Daily Mail in Britain on the 10th of March. This is an article by the well-known author Louis de Bernier. The law, and the heading of the article was "The Law Doesn't Give a Damn About Fathers." Louis Bernier is an excellent writer, as you would expect. But he was referring to an article by David Cameron, who wrote in the Sunday Telegraph one Father's Day, that and where he made a point of attacking absent fathers. I think we might recall this. Louis de Bernier, when he read this article, says that he snarled with contempt and threw the paper across the room, because clearly David Cameron has no idea that a very high proportion of fathers are absent because they are forced to be so by vindictive and possessive mothers and the family injustice system that backs them up. I think whenever he refers to the family justice system, he usually puts an in front of the justice.
Well, I actually object to the term justice in that. It's not a justice system at all. It's a legal system. Mm. You know, there's very little justice in any of it.
Well, yes, he actually goes on to say that the general public may not know that the family law is judicial. That is, it's made up by judges as they go along. And this is the case, because the judges will say, oh, no, two cases are alike, so therefore I'll do what I like. So there's no, certainly in the UK, there's no proper code of practice, no proper code of laws, except that judges will tend to follow a previous rule, and I suppose that saves them having to think about it. But in Australia, we have what's a supposed proper code of laws under the Family Law Act, but of course, as we well know, that's no guarantee of gender fairness, equity or outcome in family law, either for the children or the fathers. Judges will still do what they want, and mothers, by and large, are still the winners of child custody and the power and control and the plunder via the property and child support, that everything that comes with it. So there's so much to be done. It's great to have someone like Louis de Bernier on the side of fairness, and he has become the patron of Families Need Fathers. I think what's happened with Louis, as is often the case, his marriage broke up about 2 years ago, and all of a sudden he found himself in this situation that no one expects to arrive at, where all of a sudden he cannot expect to see his children. Everything has to be negotiated, and of course then there's the enormous negotiations on the finances, where some quite unrealistic expectations are fanned by the lawyers when they put a claim in on the money that's available to both the parties as a result of the marriage, the marital pool. So anyway, that's good to see Louis de Bernier is joining the fight. And
yeah, and of course the situation where the father is ordered to pay, towards bringing costs of the upbringing of the child, which of course is in itself is fair enough, but then of course is denied access to the child, so he has to pay for the child, which he never gets to see. I mean, that has to be an ultimate form of injustice, no matter how you look at it.
Okay, well, we might go to a short music break, and we'll be back soon with our first guest, Peter Fitzsimons.
Wasted kisses, red turns to blue. My kisses were wasted on you. Wasted hours and wasted pursuit. I was wasting my time picking the wrong fruit. The storm clouds opened. Down came the rain. Everything I thought was precious went down the drain. Wasted promises, wasted lies, wasted kisses, wasted goodbyes. Wasted kisses, red turns to blue. My kisses were wasted on you. Wasted hours and wasted pursuit. I was wasting my time picking the wrong fruit. Here today and we were wasted, baby, wasted. Wasting all my time and all my kisses on you. Wasted, baby, wasted. Wasting all my time and all my kisses on you. Yeah, we were wasted, baby, wasted. Wasting all my time and all my kisses on you. Yeah, we were wasted, baby, wasted. Wasting all my time and all my kisses on you. The story has ended. The plot has run out. The paper was wasted. Just writing it down. Wasted, wasted for miles, wasted lives, wasted smiles, wasted kisses, red turns to blue, my kisses were wasted on you, wasted hours and wasted pursuit, I was wasting my time picking. Kisses were wasted on you. Wasted hours, wasted pursuit. I was wasting my time again. The wrong fruit. Wasted kisses, wasted. My kisses were wasted on you. Wasted hours, wasted pursuit. I was wasting my time again. The wrong fruit. Wasted kisses, wasted.
Welcome back to Dad's on the Air. This 13th day of March 2012.
Marching on the year is.
And our guest this morning is Peter Fitzsimons, a man who is equally at home on both sides of the microphone. He's the author of some 23 books, including his memoir, A Simpler Time. And he's represented Australia on the sporting field. He can speak French, Italian. He's been known to speak English for more than 24 hours at a time. Peter Fitzsimons, good morning.
Good morning.
And very welcome to Dad's on the Air.
Thank you for having me. I'm having a lovely time.
It's good already. Peter, you're one of seven children and you're now the father of three children.
Yep.
I'm particularly interested for you to just tell us something about the influence of your father, who's another Peter.
Yeah, I had a very fine father, Peter McCloy Fitzsimons. He was born and bred in Warunga in 1916, grew up in a very Irish family, oddly enough. It's funny, my uncle told me not long ago that when he was at the funeral of his father, which is to say my grandfather, somebody came up to him and said, "Very nice man, Mr. Fitzsimons, but I never understood a word he said because his Irish accent was so thick," which gave me quite a shock that I'm only, you know, two generations removed from such a strong Irishman. But my father, if there was a love of storytelling in the Irish culture, I think my father picked that up and handed it on to me.
Yes.
Dad went away to the war in 1939, joined up very shortly there after the war, saw action in the Middle East, came back and fought in New Guinea, and then married a girl, sort of almost the other side of the tracks. If Dad was from a fairly well-educated but highly impoverished background, he then married my mother, Beatrice Helen Booth, in fact, who only lived 500 yards away on Warunga, but was from a very wealthy family with a driver and a cook and a businessman father and the whole thing. And then they moved up to Peach Ridge. Mum also served in the war. They moved up to Peach Ridge in 1948, bought 60 acres of land, and they raised oranges, lemons, tomatoes, and children. All seven of us, of which I was the seventh. And, you know, looking back upon it, I certainly felt at the time that I had very fine parents, since my own time of becoming a father and a parent, I have an even higher regard for them because I realise, it's not that it's difficult being a parent, I mean, given the challenges we all face as parents, I have a greater appreciation for how fantastically they somehow managed to do it without ever seeming to raise a sweat particularly.
Yes, and in your book you've made some extracts from your father's diary, and it's quite I guess you'd describe as unemotional in the diary. Like, he talks about, you know, a child being born and then he had to go and do some odds and sods.
That's right. Is
that...
Landed Valencia's, yes. James born today.
Yes. Now, do you think that's perhaps the influence of the war, that he doesn't put his emotions out there so much?
Look, he felt those emotions. He was a very loving father. I would say this, that I think of that generation of Australians, so Dad was born, as I mentioned, in 1916, raised in the 20s and 30s, whereas I was raised in the 60s and 70s. They were not demonstrative. They didn't express their love. You know, I would give my sons and my daughter more hugs in a week than I would have got from Dad in a life. You know, I mean, perhaps my father hugged me more before I was seven, but when I was at 8 or 9 and a big boy, there was less physical interaction, you know, in hugging. And I must say, when I went to live in France for 4 years to play rugby in the mid-80s, and the French are a very physical people. So you shake hands every day with everybody you know when you run across them. Women you kiss on both cheeks. If you know them very well and they're very close friends,
Sorry, Peter, did you get a shock the first time a man kissed you on both cheeks?
Yes, well, I became accustomed to it. Before I knew it, I was kissing with the best of them. But it was a very much more physical environment. And I think when I came back, I felt the need somehow with my own parents, you know, to be more physically close. And I think Dad was bemused by it. But he was a product of his generation, I think, for what it's worth. I remember once I was speaking at a dinner up in the Blue Mountains for whoever the Frank Lowy thing was, must have been Westfield at the time, and probably still is. But I was happened to be chatting to one of the Lowy sons, Frank Lowy's sons, and Frank Lowy came in, the first time I'd met him, and before he addressed a word to me, he kissed his son on both cheeks. And I remember looking at it thinking, when I'm a father, that's how I'd like to do it. And I am now a father, and that's how I do it.
Yeah, Ian Purdy here, Peter. I'd just like to add to that analogy. I actually come from New Zealand, and my father, he wouldn't allow us to hug him or wouldn't hug us until the All Blacks started hugging each other after they scored a try.
Is
so,
that right?
Yes, yes.
Is that right? Was that a positive influence on him?
Well, he said, well, if the All Blacks are doing it, then it's masculine, so you can give me a hug.
Yeah, it's funny. When I played football, I played American football in Ohio in 1978, and the first time I was sort of in a locker room, and then we'd do the rah rah rah, and then we went out and played Cincinnati Mola or something, and I did a good tackle or something, and everybody started patting me on the bottom. I thought, that is very, very odd. And
that
as
is.
The year went on, you know, there was a lot of bottom patting going on, and I thought it outrageous. Well, not outrageous, but it was just the way the Americans do it. And you now see it in rugby league, rugby union, all the time, because we sort of slavishly follow, you know, American sports, big time sports, probably the biggest sports arena there is with the Premier League in Europe. And, you know, so if it's okay for the big American footballers to pat each other on the bottom, I guess we do it too.
Yes, well, my father hasn't quite gone that far yet. He has never patted me on the bottom.
You know, your father did get to see you play rugby back in your first test against France in 1989.
Well, he basically, I mean, just about without exception, every time I played rugby in Australia from the age of 12 onwards, from under 12, you know, under 12 A's through to the first 15, Dad was at every game I played, then through Sydney University, Manly and so forth, he was at every game I played, and then New South Wales and Australia, every game I played, and, you know, a few tests overseas he missed, but yes, he was certainly extremely, extremely supportive, and one of my favourite memories was Mum and Dad. When we were all seven kids were out and gone, with the exception of my late brother Martin, who died before I was born, but Mum and Dad went on a trip to Europe in 84 or 85 when I was playing rugby in France, and they were getting to Brive railway station halfway through the match. We were playing against Toulon, and I remember playing Toulon under the lights, and, you know, I'm going away and I'm getting exhausted, and then I hear, you know, around all the French are going, allez, 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 les Briguistes, on y va, les gars, allez, allez. And then I hear this big Australian voice shout out, come on, Pete! And of course, Dad's here, and I got a new lease of life and grew another leg, and off I went again.
Yeah, and just going back to his parenting style, he was allowing a certain amount of risk taking, wasn't he, from the children?
Yeah, Mum and Dad, it's interesting, took the view that if we were old enough and ugly enough, we were big enough to do it. You know, that if you thought, basically, if you think you can do it, you can do it. And so that was, you know, everything from climbing a tree to driving a tractor to hauling up half a ton of oranges onto the back of a truck. If you thought you could do it, you probably could do it. And so we were always encouraged to, you know, be careful, but have a go and do it. They also thought if we thought we couldn't do it, well, we probably still could do it if we just, you know, took it slowly and, you know, got some instruction. But I don't think they ever read manuals or, you know what I mean, of how to, I've read quite a few books on how to raise children. And in fact, one of my favourite books is called Happy Children, which is all about the virtues of, you know, having children face consequences. And that was a huge influence on my wife and I, as we were raising our children. And the theme of it is, if you are, for example, if you're encouraging a child to eat their dinner, so for a baby, like let's say a two-year-old, and you're going, choo, 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 open up, here comes your veggies. And when the kid says, nope, I don't want it, pushes it away, nope, well, the answer to that is, oh, well, that's very simple. Okay, you don't want it, okay, well, time for bed, good night. And you take the food away, and the next morning when they wake up, they're hungry, and there'll be no more trouble, you know, having their breakfast, because they'll be hungry. So, you know, the idea will be, and this was a huge influence, as I say, the principles of us, and I do not talk to you now as somebody who's a master parent or a master father by any means. I have made errors, but they've all been errors made with love, but certainly that notion was something that I embraced as a father.
Well, that would also help with childhood obesity as well.
Well, you might have seen the piece I did on Channel 7 on Sunday night.
Yes, very impressed. You're fading away, I think.
Well, I dropped 20 kilograms. I read this book. I hate plugging books I haven't written, but I read this book, Sweet Poison, and the theme of the book is basically we're all being poisoned by sugar. And if you just cut sugar out of your diet, you drop weight and the whole thing. And I've dropped 20 kilos in 2 months simply by not having sugar, not having processed food, and I haven't gone hungry, and it feels fantastic. And I look at, I mean, we never had soft drink in our fridge, we never really had chocolates, we've had ice cream certainly, but yeah, I'm certainly a strong advocate now of vastly reducing the sugar intake in our diet.
Yes, now, all of your siblings, it's a tragic story about your brother Martin in your book, which... Mm. It's certainly in your life you've faced enormous triumph, and you've also faced disasters. And I guess that you also quote Kipling, so it made me think of the poem.
If you can meet with triumph and disaster and treat those two imposters just the same, although I would say that the death of Martin was far more than an imposter. And I one of the most moving things when I was growing up, when a young boy, a 14-year-old lad, died by the name of Jeffrey Abrook over the road from us, and he drowned in a dam, and Dad and I went to the funeral. Mum went too, but as we got there, Dad went over to see Mr. Abrook and just chatted to him briefly, and Dad said to him, and I just saw Dad talk to him, and he came back to me, and I said, what did you say, Dad? And Dad said, I said to him, Mr. Abrook, we lost one too, but you know, time heals everything, and you'll finally get over it. And then Dad paused and said to me, but you never do. And then wept a little bit, because, you know, losing a son, losing a child, losing a daughter is something that you'll never ever get over.
Yes. I think you've still got his picture where everyone can see him anyway. That's about all you can do, isn't it, at this stage. But I was also just intrigued by a story with when I think your name was Woozle.
Yep.
And Woozle, when Bertha the cow got caught.
Yes.
And that was seemed like it was a growing of age thing, a stepping
yes,
over the threshold.
It's pretty much my earliest memory that in the farmhouse the phone rang, and I must have been 3 or 4, and it was the Summersgill family down the road, Cyril Summersgill and his two brothers, and Bertha the cow was stuck in a ditch, and it was just this excitement of, you know, we need help. And Dad said, yep, we're on our way, what do you need? Yep, okay, crowbars, yep, shovels, good, yep, boys, okay, we're out. And Dad, you know, then the Fitzsimons men. So we were eight of us in the family, and three females and five males. And Dad was, of course, the boss. But the three brothers, my older brothers, went out, and Dad said, and Woozle, you can come too. And so there I am at three or four in the back of the ute, being held closely by one of my brothers, as the wind blasts in our face, and we Fitzsimons men get to work getting birth of the cow out of the ditch. And it took many, many hours and slings and pulleys and all things, but we got it out. And it was a, you know, it's interesting. So my sister Trish, I would have been four and she would have been six. Well, she was not invited to go. I was invited to go because I was the male. So it was a traditional upbringing in that sense. In my case, if I'm, you know, the way I raise my children, I would have, in exactly the same situation, I would have been inclined to take my daughter as well, so that she doesn't have a notion that she can't do physical things. Mind you, my daughter, despite me having that attitude, my daughter is far less inclined to do physical things and far more inclined to do feminine things, if I can have feminine, that didn't come out right, you know what I mean. She's far more interested in fashion.
Girly things.
She's far more interested in fashion than fixing the carburetor.
Yes. And, you know, and I guess that applies equally to some boys, but I think overall there is a trend in boy things and girl things. And I think the comment you made too after rescuing Bertha was that I've seen my father for what he is.
So, Superman.
Now, was he Superman? I mean...
Yeah, look, he was. I mean, one of the things about Dad that I mentioned at the end of the book is that I grew up, I was 29 years old before I realised that my father had a problem with depression. And I think, you know, every generation will have certainly, you know, people within, there's widespread depression within the community, and there will be differing attitudes of how you deal with it within the community. And I think probably the prevailing wisdom is to be far more open about it, to say, all right, well, I'm suffering from depression and, you know, we're going to have to cope. As a family, we'll have to work it out around it. But that was not the way it was with me. I blithely, you know, went on with my life. I always say that the line I love, if you had a happy childhood, you remember the sun shining. If you had an unhappy childhood, you remember wet Wednesday afternoons. Now, I look back upon my childhood and I remember the sun shining. I had a very, very happy childhood. Even though, looking back, there was sadness in the house. My mother never recovered, never got over the death of my brother Martin, as she wouldn't. But the sadness that she felt inside her, she managed to keep it from us a lot, so that we wouldn't be so affected. Dad suffered from pretty strong depression, including, which, you know, so bad he had to get electroshock therapy. In the early 60s until my mother put a stop to it. And yet I had no idea of it whatsoever. And I remember when Dad had a breakdown in 1989, I guess it was, and heading up to the farm. You know, Dad said, I didn't know. You know, what's going on? Oh, well, he's been, you know, having depression for a long time. And it was sort of only when we were out and grown and gone that he perhaps could allow himself to, you know, get down. And when I used to go to his cupboard, which I frequently did for various reasons, to get loose change, and Dad would tell me to, you know, go and get some money or whatever, I'd always see these tablets, and I think they were Librium or Lithium or something starting with L. And what they were tablets to make him feel better. And, you know, so he was on medication, and yet that would have been the only awareness I had, but I didn't really relate it to depression.
No, and you wouldn't know if anything triggered it because you didn't even know he had it.
No, absolutely not. But I would suspect, you know, I think the wartime, I think that there would have been things to do with the war. He was involved in heavy action, and he was, you know, from memory, I think his ACAC troop, anti-aircraft, they shot down 13 planes in the Al Alamein campaign. Now, I remember the number 13, and now that might have been something, for example, that might have troubled my father, that he was firing a gun that brought good men to ground and killed them, you know, and that was wartime, and I don't know if that was the source of his depression, because that I don't know, or if in fact, you know, depression like that just didn't have a source, it just, you feel down.
Yes, so do you find with your own children that you, as a result, you're perhaps more open with them? And
Yes, I think I am, but I don't remotely criticise. I don't know. As I say, when I'm aware that there will be differing views in the 21st century of how we deal with depression, but I don't want to go counter to whatever the experts say who have far more experience of it than me. But I can say from the perspective as an adult, I deeply admire my parents on many, many things, but including the fact that they did everything they could to ensure that we had a very, very happy childhood. You know, as I sit here talking to you now, I'm in my study, and up on the wall I see a photo of my parents in the entrance to the packing shed where we sent away all our tomatoes, and there is, you know, my father on the right, my mother on the left. They're very like that that famous Rembrandt. Is it a Rembrandt painting of the Dutch farmer with the pitchfork?
No, I think it's an American painter, but anyway.
They're smiling. They're smiling like that, unlike the Dutch painting, holding a baby and with the dog at their feet, you know, in front of their packing shed. And that's where they were pretty much 365 days a year. Now, that farm that we grew up on, I own it with my brothers and sisters, and in fact I've just beginning conversations with my brothers and sisters about, you know, how we will ensure that farm goes on to the next generation. And to have something like that, that is very stable, a stable environment to grow up in, I think was very important to us.
Yeah, so is it being farmed now, or is it...
We're cattle farmers. We're cattle ranchers. We have five head of cattle.
Okay. Now, with parents like that, you described an incident with the lost penny. So they're people you just feel you can't lie to, I guess.
Yes, the dad had on the back of his cupboard door a penny with a hole in it, and it had been with his mate. I can't remember his name. I think it was Frank, but the penny with the hole in it. But they had two pennies. They were about to go away to the war, and they secreted the penny behind a church cupboard, I think it was. And whoever came back, you know, if they both came back from the war, they'd share it. But if they didn't, one would keep it anyway. The guy didn't come back, and so Dad had the penny. And he treasured that penny, and I said, "Oh, Dad, I love that penny, love that penny, love that penny. Can I have that penny? Can I have that penny?" And Dad, well, you know, didn't really want to part with it, but I was so insistent. I said, "I'll look after it, Dad, I'll look after it." And I put it in a string, and I put it around my neck. And on the first day walking back from school, I was swinging it around and around and around and around, and it flew off my finger into the ditch, and I raced to find it. And I couldn't find it, and I searched and I searched and I searched, and I couldn't find it. And anyway, it ended up me having to confess to Dad that I'd lost it. And Dad was disappointed, but not that upset. And because the reason that he wasn't that upset was, in the end, it was only a penny. One of the things I say to my kids is, you know, in terms of upsets, there's only one thing that'll truly, truly, truly really upset me where I won't recover, and that is if there's anything wrong with them, you know, health-wise or emotional-wise or with their mother, that if they are healthy, and I say this to my wife when various upsets come along, I say, well, the kids are healthy, against that, and you're healthy and I'm healthy, against our health, there's nothing much that really, you know, other problems will come and go. It's our health. And Dad, I think, raised me on that. In the end, material things are only things. You know, they'll come and they'll go, whereas family is forever. And I certainly do, I certainly raise my kids on that, which is friends will come, friends will go. And friendships are very important. But in the end, family is forever. And that you, on various issues, I like that line from Hillary Clinton, where she said, it takes a village. And I believe, you know, it does take a village to raise a child, and it certainly takes a family. And as a small example, when my eldest boy was finishing his HSC, and we were looking about, you know, he's going to do a gap year, you know, what should he do this year? Now, he didn't have any clear ideas, but I put an email out to my brothers and my sisters and saying, who's got any ideas? And it was my brother Andrew, who's the principal at Dapto High School, who said, well, there's this crowd called Youth Abroad. You know, they can place 18-year-olds to teach English in orphanages anywhere from Vietnam to Cambodia to India. Anyway, where is my boy right now? He's having the time of his life in an orphanage, teaching English in an orphanage in Varanasi in the heart of India. And that's perhaps a less example, because that was just an idea. But mum mum always said to all of us kids whenever she left us anywhere at the fete or whatever, look after each other. And the notion of brothers and sisters looking after each other is a very important notion. And I, again, try to raise, Lisa and I, my wife and I, try to raise our kids on that notion of whatever happens, you must look after each other. Each of you, at some time in your life, is going to stumble. It's not a maybe stumble. You will stumble. You will fall over. You'll fall flat on your face, and it will happen. It's called life. But when it happens, you want the first hands to reach down to pick you up and dust you off and get you back on your bike to be your brothers and sisters, and you do the same for each other. And a couple of times in my life, I'm now 50, a couple of times in my life I have stumbled and fallen over, and it's been my brothers and sisters that have picked me up, just as I have for them.
Yes, I'm sure that that very strong family of your brothers, or your siblings, gives you that drive to then go and accomplish all the incredible things you've done in your life already.
Oh, well, that's very kind of you, but yeah.
I'm sure that's the case. Now, just talking about your mother also, I think she described the secret of good parenting, which was...
always make sure that you each child thinks that they're the favourite one.
Yeah.
And I was amazed when she heard that, because when she said that, when that came out, because I'd always known that I had been her favourite.
Yeah, it's extraordinary, isn't it?
But yeah, and certainly, you know, the thing too, I think that I always felt with my parents that it wouldn't matter if I had turned into an axe murderer. I always knew that the first visitors on the first Sunday of every month when we were allowed visitors would be my parents. And so I always had a very strong feeling of absolutely unconditional love. And I was not an extremely difficult child, but I was certainly a very difficult child to raise. And my mother at one point said to my sister Trish, should I take to him with a stick? Because I was 14 and my sister was 16. But I was always sort of arguing and argumentative and didn't want to fit in and was lazy as all get out. And drifted around. And I remember being 25 years old, and this, when I was 18 years old, my brothers and sisters quote back to me something that mum had said to me on some particular issue when I was 18. I want you to grow up right. And I said, Mum, it's too late. I'm up. I'm 18. You know, 18, I'm up. I am what I am. But I was still 25 when I heard my mother. I cannot remember the question that my aunt posed, but there was sort of a family party up on the farm, and I heard my mother say, my aunt say something like, what does Pete do most Sundays? And my mother replied, for Pete, every day is Sunday. So that was my mother's notion. It was a loving, loving comment, but her notion of me as a 25-year-old was, he's not doing that much. And the answer is, I wasn't doing that much. I was playing rugby in Europe, which was pretty good, but I wasn't doing that much in terms of career or whatever. And then, because I'd been kicking around so much, I discovered, for what it's worth, that I could write. And once I discovered writing and being published in the Sydney Morning Herald, I thought, who's been keeping this a secret? And here I am pushing 30 years later. And what am I doing? I'm writing. What was I doing when you ring? I'm writing. What will I be doing 1 minute after I get off the phone? I'll be writing.
Yes, I don't know how you pack so much into your day, but just one more story about your mother, and which I loved. It also involved your father, and that was when your sister asked your mother as she was dying.
Yeah, Dad died on the 16th of March, 92. Mum on the July 5, 94. And probably on the 4th of July, and the last full day of her life, Mum was lying, dying on the bed at home, and two of my sisters helped her just to get to the bathroom for a moment, and Mum was high on morphine. And my sister Kathy said to Mum, Mum said to my sisters, is there anything you'd like to ask me? You know, so anything you've ever wanted to ask me, now's the time, because I haven't got long. And my sister Kathy said to Mum, what's the best thing in your life? And my mother said, sex with your father. And I thought, and my family just loves that answer, because what my Auntie Mary took a very grim view of that answer, saying, my sister never would have said such a thing. Well, Auntie Mary, she did say such a thing, and we think it's fantastic, because, you know, that at the conclusion of a life and 45 years of marriage, what a fantastic thing to say that the greatest thing in her life was relations, sexual relations with our father, her husband, our father. What a fantastic thing, and I'd love to think, you know, when I'm on my deathbed, I'll be say much the same about with my wife.
Oh, don't get your hopes up, but we've run out of time. There are so many things we could talk about. I could go all day, but we've run out of time. Peter, you've picked a song for us to play. I wonder if you could just tell us what you've picked and why.
Remind me what I picked.
There was a Bob Dylan.
Oh, that's given your dad's on the air. This is dad's on the air. Do you have a notion of sometimes dads that are separated, or is it just dads generally?
Well, yes. It's both, but we do have a particular focus on separated dads who are in trouble.
If you are a separated dad, I might say that the album to listen to is Tangled, is Bob Dylan's Blood on the Tracks. Dylan released it in 1972, and the opening line is Tangled, opening song is Tangled Up in Blue, and it's all about breakups. But if you are breaking up or have broken up, you'll never hear a better album than Blood on the Tracks. And here it is. Take it away, Bobby, Tangled Up in Blue.
Thank you, Peter Fitzsimons.
Early one morning the sun was shining, I was laying in bed, wondering if she'd changed it all, if her hair was still red. Her folks, they said our lives together sure was gonna be rough. They never did like Mama's homemade dress. Papa's banquet wasn't big enough. And I was standing on the side of the road, rain falling on my shoes, heading out for the East Coast. Lord knows I paid some dues getting through, tangled up in blue. She was married when we first met, soon to be divorced. I helped her out of a jam, I guess, but I used a little too much force. We drove that car as far as we could, abandoned it out west. Split up on the docks at night, but the feeling it was best. She turned around to look at me as I was walking away. I heard her say over my shoulder, we'll meet again someday on the avenue. For a spell, but I never did like it all that much, and one day the axe just fell. So I drifted down to New Orleans, where I lucky with a bee employee, working for a while on a fishing boat right outside of Delacroix. But all the while I was alone, the past was close behind. I've seen a lot of women, but she never escaped my mind, and I just grew. Place and I stopped in for a beer. I just kept looking at the side of her face and the spotlight so clear. Later on, when the crowd thinned out, I was just about to do the same. She was standing there in back of my chair. I said to me, don't I know your name? I muttered something underneath my breath. She studied the lines on my face. I must admit, felt a little uneasy when she bent down to tie the legs of my shoes. Blue.
basement down the stairs. There was music in the cafes at night and revolution in the air. Then he started into dealing with slaves and something inside of him died. She had to sell everything she owned and froze up inside. And when it finally the bottom fell out, I became withdrawn. The only thing I knew how to do was to keep on keeping on like a bird that
in distress, meet in your area every week. If you're a non-custodian parent and would like to know who to contact or just want someone to talk to, help is just a phone call away. Dads in Distress, 1300 853 437, or dadsindistress.asn.au.
We're back with Dads on the Air.
And welcome back to Dads on the Air this Tuesday, 13 March 2012. And our next guest, a very special guest from Mullumbimby, which is just north of Byron Bay. Our guest is Neil Jeffrey Young. Neil, good morning.
Good morning.
It's great to have you on the air. Neil, you're an actor, you're a writer, you're a director, and now you're the co-author of a book on fatherhood called One Got Past the Keeper. I guess my first question is, how did you come up with the name One Got Past the Keeper?
Well, the book's about our football team. It's the true story of a six-a-side football team who got together, didn't know each other very well, and were probably celebrating after the game much more than we were actually playing the game in the first season. But then between the first and the second season, each of us wives became pregnant. And so from being mates, we suddenly all became fathers at around the same time. So the book is our story of our football team, but also the story of our individual journeys into fatherhood. So one got past the keeper seemed to be an analogy that fitted both, because plenty got past our keeper playing football. We weren't that good. And one got past the keeper as an analogy for getting pregnant worked for us.
I think you're being modest. We'll get to this in a minute, but I know in your third season you won the comp, so...
We did, actually, yes. All right, I am being modest. Thanks for spotting that.
So, it is an extraordinary story and well worth telling that of the six of the, it was a six-a-side and six of the team managed to find themselves in the family way in the second season, I think.
Yeah, I know. It's a funny thing. You know, we discussed it, and it was one, you know, as women's menstrual cycles come into tune as they hang around together, we're wondering if our fertility came in line as we were all around
together.
We were of all different ages. We were all different lengths of relationship and times of our lives. But perhaps knowing that there were other people around going through the same thing was the kind of the final thing that helped us all make the decision to do that, because we certainly didn't all talk about it and think, you know, let's all try and do this in the next 3 months.
No, in fact, it was just the opposite, wasn't it? I mean, you were mostly keeping it quiet for the at least all 3 months, or trying to keep it quiet.
Well, that's right. There's that kind of awkward period as a parent nowadays, where culturally you don't seem to be allowed to tell anyone that you're actually pregnant until you've gone past a certain 12 or 13 week window. And because of that, you know, there were two or three of us keeping quiet at some times, and one person would mention it, and the other person would kind of shuffle in their seats and go, oh, my gosh, I wish I could tell them I'm pregnant too, but I can't really yet because I haven't reached that that date.
Yes. Now, Neil Young, we've got to get this out of the way. You know, there is another famous person with that name, that soccer player from England who scored the goal in the FA Cup final, I think it was.
That's right, yes.
So I expect you have to explain that away quite a lot, and I guess... Then there's the other one, which probably causes even more grief. You've been probably confused with for many, many years.
It's funny, though. I mean, you know, I have a British accent originally, and now I've been in Australia for 25 years, but I still, when I phone up and book tables in restaurants, even if Neil Young's not in the country, I seem to get treated kind of well. When I turn up and a short, balding man appears rather than a tall Canadian, my table often gets moved. But I have actually been mistaken for him once in a hotel down in Melbourne. I'm not quite sure how, but I did get my room changed to a penthouse just on the basis of my name. Which,
oh, well, it's not all bad then, is it?
The only story I can live on, apparently, without having the same name, unfortunately.
Yes, well, I was looking for a suitable Neil Young song, and I first of all, I thought of Old Man. I thought you might take an objection to that. So I was going to go for another one, Comes a Time, but...
or probably Harvest for the fertility thing.
That's right. you are the oldest of the group, I think, aren't you?
I think I am. Well, Neil Young, the footballer, died, actually, quite recently in the last 6 months. But it was always, you know, it was a funny thing as a child growing up in England where scoring the winning goal in an FA Cup final is kind of like, you know, about as best as your life you can imagine it. And, you know, being told that, oh, you've got a famous name, I was very chuffed to go, yes, I have, I've got the same name as someone that did that, and was blissfully unaware of this other folk singer in Canada who was probably more famous, or definitely more famous to the rest of the world.
Now, in your book, the one you've co-authored, you do an intro and you do the end piece, and then it consists of all the fathers telling their individual stories.
Yeah.
Even though I think, as I said, I think you're the oldest of the footballers as well, but... But Jim was actually the captain, wasn't he, of the team?
Yeah, that's right. Jim wanted to start a football team, and he's quite a good footballer. And he kind of picked men from different circles of his life, many of whom didn't know each other. So we were quite a motley crew by the time we got together, and some of us hadn't even kicked a round ball before in their lives. I had grown up in England, but there were a couple of the Aussie boys that had, you know, been playing rugby and league and AFL, and so had never kicked a round ball. So it was a pretty motley crew at the beginning, yes.
And, you know, I'm intrigued that you know, you've come from England, as you said. You've found God's little bit of acreage up there at Byron Bay.
Right.
You've found your wife, Mette, from who you brought across from Norway.
Mette,
is it? Okay. And you've got your daughter, Zoe. And now you've gone and spoiled it all by getting pregnant again, I think.
Yeah, I know. Well, that's the sequel for the book, I guess, isn't it? I guess it went so well, we're doing it again. It's that type of thing, you know, and all the decisions about having a child. The child suddenly gets to the age of three and there's no more nappies in the house and they're sleeping through the night, and all of a sudden, for some reason, I don't know why, maybe the mother misses having a baby around, but we're about to go through it again, yes. So,
any differences? Are you noticing any differences this time from the first time? Or?
Yeah, you know, and I've talked to many people about it. You know, we're a bit more relaxed about the pregnancy. We're a bit more relaxed about anything. We don't read so many books as we did. You know, one of the reasons we wrote our book was because we couldn't really find books written by men about what the experience was like. There was plenty written by women. There was some written by couples. But any men that had written this book were, you know, experts in the field in some sort of psychology or child-rearing way. And we wanted to tell stories that were just from blokes. And so in the same way now I'm going into this, about to have a second child, I've been trying to surround myself with other men who already have two children to find out what that's like. And I can see, you know, if I hadn't given up every aspect of my own sort of self time-wise, then I'm just about to, I think, by having a second child and do total surrender.
Yeah, well, I don't want to... Going to too many predictions, but I mean, from my own personal experience, two children are sort of manageable because you've got equal numbers, but it's when you get to three that you really have the problem.
Right. It's unfair then, isn't it? It's like playing against, you know, Peter would probably agree that it's like playing against probably 18 or 19 All Blacks rather than just 15. I saw a note on the hospital wall where we go and take our baby for checkups, and, it said, you know, when you have your first child, you're constantly just staring at it and looking at it and totally engrossed. When you have your second child, you're trying to stop the first child from hitting the new child. And when you have your third child, by the time you have your third child and beyond, you spend a little bit of every day hiding from your children.
Well, it's hard for you because I think you're still working at home.
Yes, I am working from home, and that's a, you know, a whole other issue. But you know, something that I've discussed with other people that work from home. And as a sort of follow-up to the book, me and the other guys in the team do a blog, which is at www.fertilefc.com, where you can read the continuing journeys of us as now new parents and new fathers and the things that happen. And, you know, working from home, there's a blog around that issue because, it is difficult when your wife comes down and says, no, this is important, hold the baby, I've got to fill the washing machine. And, you might have cut on the machine, but you may not have pasted. And So, working on the computer as I do, it can be a bit tricky sometimes.
And did you find, I mean, you came to marriage fairly late and it was all very romantic. Did you find that having the child has changed your relationship with Meta?
Yeah, absolutely. You know, I mean, one of the things that we discussed briefly in the book is that every man should be prepared if he marries a woman or gets involved in a long-term relationship with a woman who's in her early to mid-30s, then it's going to come up. And at some time you're going to have to make a decision about whether you want to either give her that or deny her that right to have a baby. And even though I was 13 years older than her, I still had to kind of consider that, well, from my own perspective and from her perspective, was this the right thing to do?
I think a lot of fathers, as you did, talk about the fact that you're no longer the one person in her life. All of a sudden you've got a bit of competition.
Yeah, I know. I used to be the most, her most favourite thing. And now I'm her second most favourite thing, and very soon I'm about to be the third most important person in her life.
Well, lucky she hasn't got a dog.
I'm going to get a dog, I think, or a cat or something, just so that I'm not bottom of the rung. There's somebody I can kick after I'm kicked by all the others.
Now that all six of you have had children, do you tend to swap notes, or do you tend to go off on your own adventures?
We go off on our own adventures now, I think. We probably don't see as much of each other as we're not all playing football. One of us has moved out of the area a little. But it's that thing about when you're just about to embark on becoming a father, it's a little terrifying and you have no idea what's in store. People tell you it's going to be difficult, but the biggest thing we were hearing was people told me it was going to be hard, but I never knew it would be this hard.
Yes.
And so that was just like, oh, my goodness, what on earth does that mean? Mm. So, writing this book was about trying to tell six different stories about that experience, right from meeting the partner, having the discussion about babies, the conception, the pregnancy, and all the way through to indeed bringing the baby home. So, we're now 3 years up the track, and so I don't think we think we're experts by any means, but we've had 3 years' experience at this thing, whereas, when you've only had a week's worth of experience, you really still have no idea what you're doing.
Yes, well, I think the great part about this book, too, is that with all the different experiences, you've got such a range of fathers that I'm sure most fathers picking the book up will find something of themselves
something
in it.
Yeah, I know. It was weird. There's a number of different sort of different constellations and birthing experiences. There's three first-time fathers, including myself, who was 49 at the time. There's one father having his second child, one father with a stepchild, and one father already with children to a different partner. And the births are all different too. I think there's a natural home water birth, a home birth with a trip to hospital, a birthing centre birth, an elective caesarean, and an emergency caesarean. So there's the whole kind of, well, not the whole, but there's quite a range there of different type of birthing experience to give any prospective father or man reading it an idea of how different and unique this experience is.
And I think it's great that the plans changed, and what had been intended to be a natural home birth finished up being in hospital, and some people might have a sense of guilt about it, but the way you deal with it in the book, it's all just sort of natural. And with Meta, she was quite used to having to go to a large hospital, so no problem. You focus on the child,
yeah.
Don't you?
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, it's interesting. It kind of depends what sort of expectations you have and how you set it up, isn't it? I mean, up here in Mullumbimby, it's just north of Byron Bay, as you said, and alternative births and alternative medicine are actually the norm here. It's quite an alternative birth to go to hospital. It's alternative up here not to have a tattoo. it's a slightly different area from that regard. But, culturally, everyone's sort of influenced by their past and their peers and where they are. And so, each of the women in our stories had, I think, slightly different expectations about how it would go and different wishes for how it would go. You know, some of those came off, some of those didn't, and we try and talk openly and candidly about that, not from the woman's perspective, from about how it affected us and about the changes in her affected us, because it really is... We tried to get across in this book as a very conversational kind of style, like it was a bloke sitting down in a pub with another bloke having a yarn.
Yes.
And because we think that's the way men kind of, you know, relate best. There's plenty of humour in it, because men are also quite good at that, I think. But, you know, we hope that this might, you know, help contribute to a debate of fathers telling stories about their birth so that they can become more involved in their children at the very early stages, which is traditionally a time when the women just go, look, you know, walk away, this is nurturing time and you're not really needed.
Yes, and we're speaking with Neil Young, a co-author of a book, One Got Past the Keeper, the true story of Fertile FC and amateur football team's journey into fatherhood. Now, the team's name actually changed, didn't it? It started off as the Rusty Trombones, then it changed to another one, now it's back to the Trombones, I think.
Yeah, that's right. Well, we changed our name to Fertile FC just for a bit of a laugh, because it was such a unique experience we were going through. But then... when the babies started showing up on the sideline, that was, you know, particularly apt. But the following season, when all of our women weren't coming to watch the games because they were home looking after a young baby, it seemed a bit like we were putting dibs on ourselves if we were calling ourselves Fertile FC and trotting around, you know, trying to catch the eye of the other women who were watching. So we changed our name back, yeah.
Now, you mentioned that you're now, I think you're 50 now, and you're having your second child. Have you given any thought to, you know, like being an older father? I suppose a lot of fathers, first time would be sort of mid to late 20s.
There was an article in this weekend's Sydney Morning Herald about that, interestingly enough, and it made me feel quite young. And Mike Carlton was talking about, you know, being 58, and there's other fathers there that are in their 60s. And I guess, you know, thanks to Mick Jagger and other people who have grown old disgracefully, it's I don't think, you know, 50 doesn't seem that old anymore. I think if I was in my 60s, I'd consider myself an elderly father, but I think I still have energy, and I think I'm, you know, if I look at the age I'm going to be when my daughters are 14 and 16, then, you know, I'm pretty okay with that. It might be different if it were boys, I think, perhaps. But I know that I'm having another girl now, so two girls, I think.
Well, congratulations on that.
Thank you very much. Yes, a little for me.
Well, look, you're doing the right thing. You're getting out there, I presume. You're still kicking that ball around?
Yeah, I had a rest last season, actually. I may have retired. I may return next year, but I'm definitely keeping myself fit. And as any, you know, father would know, having children yourselves keeps you fit. The bending down, the carrying, the squat lifts, and the most of the exercise you have to do, just managing a baby and a toddler, let alone a small child once they get bikes and want to climb up things.
Yes. And, well, your book, it does cover a lot of things. As you said, there's a lot of humour, there's a lot of storytelling, there's great male bonding, there are all these things. But there's also the tragedy of Antonio, the last story in it, and I think the book's dedicated to Antonio. I'm sure you don't want to say too much more about it because of the privacy reasons, but how did you all deal with the fact that one of the children that was expected didn't in fact make it?
Yeah, well, you know, we wanted to include it in the book because it did happen, but then we didn't want to include it in the book out of respect for the families involved who had, you know, requested that was pretty much the end of it. So eventually we came to a kind of like a compromise and mentioned it, but tried to put it, you know, from our perspectives. It's something we've all said, you know, we're really not going to talk about because the families have asked us not to anymore. But in the book we do cover the fact that it happened, and I think it's important that, you know, everyone knows that that is one of the possibilities, and occasionally that does happen at childbirth. You know, we've got some websites in there and some support lines for people, other people that tragedy may happen to. And there's some, you know, some good books out there that that we all had a look at, you know, leading up to birth. But one of those things that happens, and, you know, once you have a baby, it's just the most beautiful thing. And you know, there's a line in the book that from the father that lost that baby that says, you know, don't be upset about your child screaming at night. It is one of the most beautiful sounds in the world.
Yeah, that's a very touching comment, and. To get through that, and does make you appreciate things. I hadn't, until I saw it in your book, I hadn't realised that. I think it's one in four pregnancies, in fact, you don't have a live, healthy baby.
I think those statistics change obviously during the length of the pregnancy, I think, and after so many weeks that comes down a lot. But there's still a larger number than all of us think of babies that are, you know, that don't make it through that very difficult kind of birth period, for one reason or another. And, you know, it's, while we were each lucky enough, that the rest of us that wrote the book were lucky enough to have a fantastic experience, each of us. You know, our hearts do go out and, to that couple and other couples that aren't as lucky enough and have some sort of tragedy in their life at that stage.
Yeah, and look, I think it's very important to tell that story as well. For you know, we've spoken to other people on this program. In one particular, Pillars of Strength is a new group to help help dads in particular who have to go through that experience. So it's very worthwhile thing to provide that encouragement.
Yeah.
So what's the impact on the players of having this perhaps unexpected baby when you started playing football? Are they all keen to sign up again, or like you, or they think they've...
We've dissipated a little. We've got a few new players now, basically because they're better footballers. some of the people have moved away, as I said. I'm considering retirement now. But, you know, I guess at the time, the one thing it did do was doubled our fan base, because previously we only had our wives and girlfriends watching us, and then gradually we'd have pregnant wives watching us, and then all of a sudden we had wives with prams watching us, and now we have wives and toddlers watching us, and... instead of only about six people watching us, there's now 12 at least, because each of us has a child. if we're not building our own football team, we're at least building our own supporter base.
Yeah, it's gone from success to success, hasn't it?
And
it'd be nice if you could hand your jersey on to the next generation, you know, if you could keep going that long.
Yes, well, my daughter's taken lessons with little kickers up here in the far north, northern New South Wales, and... So, you know, I hope she continues to play football for the good things it can do, you know, for balance and exercise and all those good things that are good for toddlers.
Now, Neil, I wonder if before you got involved with this, you were involved in the Uncle Project up that way. I wonder if you could just tell us a little bit about that.
Yes, Uncle is a mentoring program and an activities program for boys whose fathers are unable to be present. Years ago, when this was started, about 10 years ago, there was a very, very high incident of single-parent families up here on the north coast of New South Wales. Most of those, nearly all of those, were women, and there were lots of boys. There were lots of boys who were without male support. They were taking their guidelines for role models from TV or film or sport. And they're not always good role models. So Uncle was started by a group of men to try and be present, to show boys, men reacting well together, to show them men being good to women and those sorts of things, and also being there to kind of wrestle and, for want of a better word, some responsible irresponsibility, you know, some tree climbing, some wrestling, some camping and that sort of stuff that the mother was finding it very difficult to do. We also had a lot of fathers that would come along as well. There were estranged fathers that would come to Uncle activities because they were either a little out of practice or a little vulnerable in trying to find things to do with their own sons. So they would come to these events in an all-male environment just so that they could be comfortable with their son in like a gang kind of environment to do fun activities.
Yeah, look, that's great. And you were the CEO of Uncle. I wonder if you could give us a couple of addresses. Perhaps for Uncle, first of all, if people wanted to get in contact with Uncle and perhaps get involved, where should they go?
I think www.uncle.org.au would be a website, which would be a good first place to go.
Great.
And I think byron@uncle.org.au is the email, but I'm pretty sure that is the website. Sorry, I don't have it at my fingertips.
That's fine. They can track it down. And once more, you've got a blog for One Got Past the Keeper?
Yes, we've got a blog for One Got Past the Keeper, which is www.fertilefc.com. We've got a Facebook page, One Got Past the Keeper, and we're on Twitter @FertileFC. We also, there's another organisation that was started up here on the North Coast that we give proceeds of the book to, which is called the Fatherhood Project, which is www.fatherhood.net.au. Fatherhood is an organisation that supports fathers in every aspect and tries to promote, you know, the role of father in society and civilisation. They do things particularly like helping fathers who are working away from home a lot. They run programs for young fathers, like 16 to 21. And so, you know, they're another good organisation for men, I think, to get involved in just building that strength and building that voice in the community.
Great. That's all very worthwhile. Now, we're just about out of time, Neil Young, but I asked you if you could pick a song, and you've picked a song. I just happened to know that the song was, in fact, it's a David Bowie song, and it was dedicated to David Bowie's son, Zoe, which I thought was a bit unusual, considering the name of your daughter.
I know, it's a small world. All that came up afterwards, and I had no idea about that. And, you know, Zoe, as anyone would know, some people may know, has changed his name now to Duncan and is a very famous film director.
Yes, that's right. Now, I think the story, or the song you picked, is Kooks by David Bowie, and we're going to play it in a second, but I know, well, you can perhaps tell us that I think it's one you sing to your daughter, and I was just hoping we might get a few bars of the song from you yourself.
Is that possible? You're up for Neil Young singing live on your radio show.
That's right. We're going to advertise it.
Sure. Will you stay in my lover's story? If you stay, you won't be sorry, 'cause we believe in you. Soon you'll grow, so take a chance with a couple of kooks hung up on romancing.
Oh, that's great. Neil Young, thank you very much. And we'll now go to David Bowie. Thank you very much for being on the program, and all the very best from Dad's on the Air.
Thank you, Bill. Thank you. All the best.
Thank you.
Bye.
Will you stay in our lover's story? If you stay, you won't be sorry, 'cause we believe in you. Soon you'll grow, so take a chance with a couple of kooks hung up on romancing. Will you stay in our lover's story? If you stay, you won't be sorry, 'cause we believe in you. Soon you'll grow, so take a chance with a couple of kooks hung up on romancing. We bought a lot of things to keep you warm and dry, and a funny old crib on which the paint won't dry. I bought you a pair of shoes, a trumpet you can blow, and a book of rules of what to say to people when they pick on you. 'Cause if you stay with us, you're gonna be pretty cookie too. Will you stay in our lover's story? If you stay, you won't be sorry, 'cause we believe in you. Soon you'll grow, so take a chance with a couple of kooks hung up on romancing. And if you ever have to go to school, remember how they messed up this old fool. Don't pick fights with the bullies or the cats, 'cause I'm not much cop at punching other people's dads. And if the homework brings you down, then we'll throw it on the fire and take the car downtown. Will you stay in our lover's story? If you stay, you won't be sorry, 'cause we believe in you. Soon you'll grow, so take a chance with a couple of kooks hung up on romancing. Will you stay in my lover's story? If you stay, you won't be sorry, 'cause we believe in you. Soon you'll grow, so take a chance with a couple of kooks.
Dad's in distress, meet in your area every week. If you're a non-custodian parent and would like to know who to contact or just want someone to talk to, help is just a phone call away. Dad's in Distress, 1300 853 437, or dadsindistress.asn.au.
We're back with Dad's on the Air.
And we're back for the last time this Tuesday, 13th of March 2012. We've run out of time. Hope you enjoyed our great guests today. We had Peter Fitzsimons in Sydney and Neil Young in Mullumbimby. And just to let you know about next week's show, this will be a show dedicated to issues for Aboriginal men and boys. We'll be speaking to Aaron Stewart, the manager of Aboriginal Project Centre Care Catholic Family Services in Port Augusta, South Australia, and also Craig Hammond, who is the leader of Indigenous programs at the University of Newcastle. So don't forget our web address, dadsontheair.com.au, and you can find us on Facebook and join us on Twitter. Until next week, it's goodbye from Dads on the Air.
That's it.
We ask all the questions that others don't.